Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to PassCast. This week, we're talking about the Ford Thunderbird. By the end of this episode, you're going to be looking up 10th gen SCs on Bring a Trailer all day. These are some cool cars. There's some really not cool cars in this episode as well. But it's an interesting story, and I can't believe it's been 20 years since the Thunderbird died in 2005. It's pretty crazy. Let's get right into it. In the years following World War II, automotive designers found influence in the vehicles that propelled the Allies to victory. And while fighter planes gave us tail fins and jet age insignia, automakers would also borrow from the civilian rides that young American soldiers swooned over on the streets of England, Germany, and Italy. These weren't your average autos. They were something that hardly roamed the road stateside. Sports cars. As post-war occupations took root, servicemen got their hands on Jaguars, MGs, pre-war Bugattis, and the like. They loved how lightweight, nimble, and fast these tiny two-seaters were. When their tours were up, some servicemen even brought them home. It didn't take long for domestic automakers to take note of the sports car craze. While several limited-run options were offered domestically in the late 40s and early 50s, Chevrolet led the legacy automakers into the sports car market with the debut of their Corvette in 1953. The fiberglass roadster sent Ford executives scrambling for a rebuttal. And to their surprise, a small group of Ford engineers and designers had already spent more than a year toiling away on a secret project. What they had come up with would not only combat the Corvette, but would also shape and reshape the automotive landscape for the next 50 years. Today on Pass Gas, it's a tale of adaptation and experimentation, with a vehicle that at times struggled to find an identity and created a class all of its own. It's time to get to know the Ford Thunderbird. Welcome to the show, everybody. I am your host, Nolan Sykes, joined as always by Bart Bidlingmeyer across the table.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Bart.
You should say joined as often, because I don't think I was here last week.
And sparsely joining us.
Okay, yeah.
Peppered
throughout this series.
Yeah.
Is
Jimmy Hilton.
Happy to be here. Happy to be peppered in.
Okay.
Yeah. And it fits because he's spicy.
Jimmy, I like salt. So. I like salt on
salty,
things.
Salty, salty, too. He salted in. How's that?
Jimmy, what are you ordering for lunch today?
It's family style, so I will be, you know, putting a little meat.
Buttered noodles.
Buttered noodles, okay. Pretty much.
I'll never forget when you ordered buttered noodles at Cheesecake Factory.
A lot of people have told me about that moment. Yeah. That it is a pivotal moment.
You've come a long way, though.
I have. Yeah, Devin has really opened my eyes to food.
Parmesan on your buttered noodles.
Yeah. Was that before you and
Devin
were
together? Yeah, that was before.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she changed you in that way.
She did.
And then you guys soon will be joined in marital bliss. And then
we will be.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
You should be.
I'm stoked.
It's good. Yeah. It's a good time. You should be. It being married is cool.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Get married.
Everybody get married.
Everybody do what feels right for you.
That's what I was gonna say. That's what I was gonna say. If you, marriage fits me well. The tropes of like my wife, you know, like, she doesn't let me do the things. It's like that doesn't really apply to me. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's good. It's been nice. I've been having to take care of her after a surgery. It feels good to take care of someone.
I see.
You know.
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, Ford Thunderbird, Jimmy.
Weird one.
Art.
Yeah.
Weird one.
Yeah.
You say.
I mean, it's like a Palm Springs car.
It is a Palm Springs. Well, it depends. The early ones.
The new ones. Mm-hmm. Like it's just very like pink. I mean, like it's pink. They're outrageous. I don't know. If I go to Palm Springs, I'm gonna see one.
You probably will see one. Yeah.
Like I feel like every time I go to Palm Springs,
they that first gen. What did have a lot of like coral colors,
very pastel. Yeah, I've rented one that was like a sky blue.
I remember that one
kind of Thunderbird. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Leaked oil everywhere.
Did it?
I feel like it did.
Might have. I don't know. It was fun though. It's cool. And then the later ones, the '60s ones, that have like the pointy noses. I love those. Those are very cool. And then like later on when they're like in the '80s and '90s,
yeah,
that's when it gets a little weird.
That's when you get into Phil Soulier territory.
Yes, director Phil here at Donut. And then you get the 2000s retro reboot.
Right.
That Halle Berry drove in Die Another Day.
I don't remember that.
You don't
I remember her being in it. Yeah. I don't remember that she drove that.
That's what she drove. That was her car.
That is like such a PT Cruiser car. Like it's in the same kind of ballpark where it's like trying to be classic.
The retro futurist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to see someone make one of those like really sick.
Just slam it on its nuts and
Well,
VSKFs on it.
Yes. Many American manufacturers faced unprecedented challenges during and after World War II. But for the Blue Oval, the era was especially turbulent. In 1943, Edsel Ford, who had served as president of the Ford Motor Company since 1919, died unexpectedly, forcing his aging father, Henry Ford, to reassume the role. But the job was beyond Henry's capacity. His mental acuity had faded in recent years, and his erratic decisions and unwarranted mistrust of his team cast serious doubts on his ability to lead during critical wartime production.
Oh,
man, that must suck to have someone in charge who's got fading mental capacities making random decisions that you can't really explain.
Making bombers and Ford didn't make did they make tanks?
I'm not
sure. I think that was General Motors. But
yes, I feel you, Bart. Yeah. I like that. Yeah, Henry Ford, the guy who like loved eating weeds around his house.
Well, this isn't Henry Ford the Elder.
It is Henry Ford.
Dang.
Hank the Deuce, Henry Ford II, was in the 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is OG Henry Ford.
Whoa.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Don't call it a comeback.
I mean, it wasn't, is what we're hearing.
In response, Edsel's son, Henry Ford II, was called home from the Navy and named as vice president at just 25 years old, vice president of FOMOCO.
Right.
He's in the Navy.
He's in the Navy at 25, and they're like, hey,
can you come back?
That's how
we need your captains of industry to come back home.
Right. It's pretty crazy that they're that rich that they could be like, you know how I know we're in a war.
Yeah.
Pull them out.
But we need this guy to run Ford.
Pretty crazy. This was a crash course in industrial leadership. Just a few weeks after the end of the war, he took over as president and CEO.
Oh, they didn't pull him out of the war.
It was 43.
Oh, so
yeah,
we're
in. We're in.
I got it. So they brought
him home.
We're
in Italy by that time.
They're training him up.
Yeah.
And at the end of the war, he takes charge.
His nickname is Hank the Deuce.
Great.
Yeah. Upon his arrival at Ford, the Deuce implemented a significant shakeup in its leadership. Hank was aware of his inexperience and recruited seasoned executives like Ernst Breech from General Motors and brought in a team of bright young veterans from the Air Force known as the Whiz Kids, which included future Ford president Robert McNamara. Amid all these shifts, and as we mentioned at the top of the episode, MGs, Jaguars, and other European sports cars began appearing on American roads, often brought home by returning servicemen. Others turned to hot rodding, and specialty builders like Curtis, Ronco, and Cunningham debuted their own limited-run roadsters to rival these imports. In 1949, Crosley introduced the Hot Shot, the first mass-produced American sports car. That same year, most major automakers launched their first all-new post-war designs. Ford's low-slung shoebox style earned praise, while GM and Chrysler stuck with more bulbous looks. Bulbous.
I go into car dealerships. You got any bulbous cars here? I don't want anything if it's not bulbous.
If it ain't bulbous, no. No deal.
I'm just letting you guys
know. No deal. Deal's off.
Deal's off. Still, GM, led by Harley Earl, set enduring trends like tail fins, first seen on 1948 Cadillacs, an element designed by Frank Hershey. Earl also pioneered concept cars like the Buick Y-Job, and most importantly, championed the idea of a domestic sports car for GM. When Hershey later joined Ford in the early 50s, he brought that inspiration with him.
We have an industry in flux at this time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new kind of world order. America hasn't, you know, aside from Pearl Harbor, we right. weren't really affected in the same way at
our,
all.
Our infrastructure is intact.
Yes, completely intact. Thus, our economy is completely intact and ready to just be thriving. And
the New Deal.
And we've got all this new roads. Tech. We've got
all these new roads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got all the new tech.
That's true. So we're just primed for a middle-class explosion, plenty of people with expendable income to purchase cars like this Crosley hotshot.
That is so cool. What? I wanted to say cute, but it's cool, too. It's a.
It's.
Don't they have one of those at the Peterson?
I don't
know. Probably.
I think I've seen one of those in person.
That thing is so cool.
That is hilarious, dude.
Dude, I want to buy that and then just ship it to Catalina Island, just drive it around.
Yeah,
there.
That's good. It does. It's golf cart.
Yeah.
In proportions. Yeah, dude, throw a freaking rotary in there.
Whoa,
make like dude,
little 12A.
Yeah, dude, make like 600 horsepower with a turbo.
Call up Rob Dom.
Call up Rob Dom.
Robbie baby, I got your next project for you here.
Robbie baby, I saw Rob earlier this year. Very nice guy.
I want to meet him. Talk to him about Miatas and Mazdas. Mm. That'd be cool.
He's a cool guy.
We'll be right back after these messages.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Now back to the show.
Under Earl's leadership, the European-inspired Corvette debuted at the GM Motorama in New York City on January 17, 1953. It sent shockwaves through Detroit, and Ford execs fell into a frenzy. But unbeknownst to them, Hershey, designer George Walker, and vice president of Ford's car and truck division, Louis Crusoe, had been spending their free time taking stabs at what a Ford sports car may look like for more than a year before the Corvette's debut. Within just weeks of the Corvette's unveiling, full-size mock-ups of their new car appeared in the war rooms at Ford. Hank the Deuce and his crew provided input and pressed the team to get it ready for action as soon as possible. They did so using every tool imaginable, including the Corvette itself.
Uh-oh.
The team had a tight deadline, with a public debut set for February of 1954. As the day drew near and the prototype neared completion, one thing had yet to be decided. A moniker, or a name.
What are we going to call this thing?
Well, name.
Ford moniker.
Names like the Detroiter, Runabout, Seville, and Beaver
No.
All earned a second look, but none properly reflected what they were building. Yeah, I got that new Ford Beaver. Mm-hmm. Got that car you wanted, boss.
Sure, Jaguar, that's a good one. That's a good animal to name. Yeah,
it's
a
great
after.
Animal. Yeah. Powerful.
Cougar. Mercury Cougar. There's a good one. Cougar. I mean, there's a lot of animals out there.
Panther.
The panther.
Tiger, yeah. Even.
Platypus would have been good.
Where's Joe?
But beaver. Anyway. Ford was hoping to carve out a brand new niche, and an internal contest was held to find the perfect name. Stylist Aiden Giberson's submission got the vote. So they're naming kids. His name was Alden Giberson. I was like, Aiden? They're naming kids Aiden back then.
Is it Giberson or Giberson?
Yeah, probably Giberson.
I went to school Aiden with a guy Giberson. Named Giberson.
It's probably Giberson. When the doors to the first post-war Detroit auto show opened on February 20th, 1954, thousands of people streamed into the Michigan State Fairgrounds. While the usual suspects displayed their latest sedans and pickups, the Ford display attracted people for a different reason. An all-new two-seater emblazoned with the name Thunderbird.
Nice.
Yeah, can we get some thunder?
Yeah, you need both the bird and the thunder. Yeah. Thank you, Jimmy.
Journalists hit the wire to give their takes on Ford's newest sports car. But Ford had an interesting response. They claimed it wasn't a sports car at all, but rather a personal luxury vehicle that wrapped performance and grandeur into a neat 3,000-pound package.
Whoa. What a name. Personal luxury vehicle.
So what's the difference between a sports car and personal luxury? What sports cars lacked in convenience, they generally made up for in performance. The T-Bird attempted to offer both. It had power brakes, steering and windows, plus an automatic transmission, sound deadening, a removable hardtop, and functional heater, radio, and other accessories. It also had a steel body as opposed to the fiberglass Corvette.
I'm assuming all of that was optional.
Honestly, I would guess not, honestly. Like, this is...
That's what again, you get.
It's the personal luxury car.
Yeah.
Yeah, and perhaps the most impressive aspect of the whole car sat under the hood. The 292 cubic inch, 198 horsepower Y-block V8 featured in the concept shed light on a stark failure of its market foe, the Corvette. In its second year, 1954, the fiberglass sports car still only carried one engine option, the Blue Flame six-cylinder that produced a paltry 155 horses.
198 for the T-Bird?
Yeah, dude.
That seems like a lot back then.
Yeah, in the mid-50s, that's pretty impressive.
Darling, they got this thing called the Thunderbird. It's 198 horsepower.
The public response to the Thunderbird was overwhelmingly positive, earning it a green light for the next model year. Following a few refinements, the first production T-Birds left the River Rouge plant in Dearborn, Michigan on September 9th, 1954. When sales started on October 22nd, some 4,000 people left deposits with their local dealers. The Cleveland-built Ford V8s found their way into the production model and could be paired with a 3-speed Ford-O-Matic or 3-speed manual with or without overdrive. The move forced Chevy to take action, finally giving the Corvette a V8 for 1955. Yet, plenty of differences remain between the two cars, and in the eyes of consumers, the luxury of the Thunderbird far outweighed the Corvette's performance gains. Sitting at the top of Ford's lineup, the new Thunderbird cost $2,944 in 1955, about $35,000 today. Not bad. I was expecting more. Even at $40 more than a Corvette, Ford couldn't keep them on the lots. Ford smashed its sales goal of 10,000 units, selling 16,155 T-Birds in 1955.
Dang.
Meanwhile, Chevy managed to move only 700 Corvettes. Oof. Damn. That's crazy.
But that was their strategy, right? To do so. It's like, all right, if you're looking at a Corvette, we're going to make you decide between a car that does one thing and a car that does everything you're used to and the thing the other car does.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is... solid.
Yeah.
That's why the luxury, right?
The luxury. Exactly. It's interesting because I think today, I mean, certainly something we talk about a lot and other people in our car space talk about is like, oh, consumers these days just want convenience. They want luxury.
Right.
That's why manufacturers don't make sports cars, is because like people won't buy them because they want all the convenience. But it's like,
it's actually happened in the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always been like that.
Always.
Yeah. We love our treats.
Yeah.
Love our...
I love a good sweet treat.
We love our sweet treats here, Jimmy. Yeah. Ford had a winner on its hands, but they also had a big problem. It cost more to produce the car than they could sell it for. In the eyes of Crusoe, the VP of the Ford division, it didn't matter. This was the brand's halo car. It attracted buyers to the showroom for sedans, wagons, and trucks, and away from General Motors and Chrysler products. Crusoe, like Hank the Deuce, loved the car. They both added model year touches. Crusoe suggested the iconic porthole window for 1956 to improve visibility.
Very aquatic.
Improve visibility for who?
Yeah, for what?
Submariners.
Yeah. I guess when you're like backing out, you could look back there. And Henry Ford II took inspiration from the Lincoln Continental for the rear-mounted spare, which addressed an issue he had with the car. The trunk wasn't big enough to carry golf clubs. That was a problem worth solving back in the 1950s.
Super important. If you can at least fit one club, you're good.
Yeah, one club. Which one?
Which one club?
Nine iron.
Nine iron. You can putt with that too.
Sure.
Okay. But Robert McNamara, working under Crusoe, argued that every unit needed to be profitable on its own, and the 2-seat Thunderbird wasn't pulling its weight. He knew customers routinely asked dealers if the car came with a back seat. Some walking away because it was too small. He believed this to be the answer to the production cost problem. While the 1957 model was too far along for changes, McNamara's vision soon prevailed. The final 2-seat Baby Bird rolled off the line on December 13th, 1957, effectively ending any rivalry with the Corvette. In truth, plans for a larger Thunderbird had been underway since late 1955. When the 58 model debuted, it was 2 feet longer, featured a unibody design to retain its low-slung look, and it seated 4 people.
Were people upset at this?
I doubt it, because they didn't market their car as a sports car.
So they could never.
So it's not like
go back and be like, right. Oh, well, it's a sports car. What are you doing?
Right.
Ooh, yeah, this second-gen Thunderbird. I do not.
Do we have a pick?
It's pretty. I mean, it's cool. I would definitely drive that.
What year is that? Around,
that's 58.
That looks like an Edsel.
It is somewhat Edsel-like, yeah, when those headlights. Yeah, you're right, Jimmy.
I don't know. This is the dark times of Ford.
The 57, though, I think I rented a 57 to take our engagement pics, but I love those first gens, man.
Yeah, it looks They're so great.
It's also really funny to think, like, yeah, it's got a big V8 for the time, but that thing was, like, one of the slowest cars I've ever driven.
Of course, because It's a big, heavy boat.
Yeah. 3,000 pounds, though. Not bad.
Okay.
It was fun, though. We took it up to, like, the top of Stunt Road.
Nice. It's a good drive.
Yeah. It was really fun. Just cruised along PCH. And that's, like, 55 miles an hour in a car built in the 50s is, like, the perfect kind of, like, speed. Great car. I want to buy one.
Every car you drive, you want to buy.
Well, Chloe, in particular, Chloe loved that car. And I was like, if this is the...
Did she have, like, was she wearing, like, a long scarf with sunglasses?
Her hair was.
Oh, dang.
She did wrap something around to, like, protect it because we were taking photos, you know. So, anyway, it's great. Yeah, she had the whole 50s.
That's how it would have been.
We weren't, like, dressed up like greasers or anything. We didn't have, like, a 50s look.
Have you seen that guy on TikTok or Instagram Reels who, like, dresses up as a greaser?
No. What did he do?
So fun. He's just like, things I'm not worried about. My car breaking down and being judged by like others for being this. It's so funny. I got to show it to you later. It's really funny.
The third generation Thunderbird set the stage for the big two-door coupes of the 1960s. It didn't just grow in size. It packed more power, too. A 352 cubic inch FE series V8 making 300 horsepower gave it the muscle to match its extended footprint and made it ideal for cruising the growing American highway system. McNamara's gamble paid off. The 1958 Thunderbird earned Motor Trend's Car of the Year and outsold its predecessor by 16,000 units. The momentum continued in 1959 with a 350 horsepower engine and a vast array of customization options, including 19 solid colors, 41 two-tone schemes,
whoa,
and 14 seat material and color combos.
Oh, that's
line
sick.
To divide, the chrome line dividing.
That's cool.
Two-tone. I like that. Or top.
That's insane. By the end of the decade, annual sales climbed to nearly 93,000 units, cementing the four-seater's success. Nice. It seemed that nothing could stop the Thunderbird. But changes soon hit Ford, and the Thunderbird's once niche market started to get crowded. As the 61 started rolling off the line, the car's champion, Robert McNamara, became the president of Ford, the first to hold the position from outside the family since 1906. But it wouldn't last. He left 2 months later to become newly elected President John F. Kennedy's Secretary of Defense. Then the competition really came knocking. Oldsmobile introduced the Starfire for 1960 as a direct response to the T-Bird.
Dang, that's a cool name.
And yeah, and Buick followed in 1963 with the Riviera. The Thunderbird even found itself in competition with the more expensive Chrysler 300 letter series. Ford's own line also carved into sales. The Galaxy offered similar performance and could be had with four doors, and so too could the Mercury Monterey. The personal luxury space became crowded in the mid-1960s, but the Thunderbird nameplate held strong through generational redesigns in 1961 and 64, the latter nearly receiving a front-wheel drive layout.
What?
That'd be crazy. More room, though.
That's true.
Yeah. As the Pony Corps.
That's one of your open tabs.
As the pony car wars took off in the mid-1960s and a flood of new competition came gnawing at the T-Bird, Ford struggled to place it in its lineup. Lee Iacocca, vice president of Ford's car and truck group,
had
a unique idea. Known for helping to create the Mustang, the car that ultimately stole the Thunderbird's sporty image, Iacocca had a talent for reading the market. When it came to the Thunderbird, he believed the public wanted more doors. Iacocca's version of the T-Bird, now available as a two-door or a four-door with rear-hinged suicide doors,
oh, that's cool.
That's sick.
Became an image car. It was less sporty than ever, but it upped the entire ante on luxury. It also reduced costs by sharing production with the Lincoln Continental Mark III. When designing the Mark III, Iacocca told stylists to, quote, put a Rolls-Royce grill on the Thunderbird.
Whose idea was... This is interesting to me because I would have thought that Lincoln was the one that
right?
was like, we want to do these doors because they're famous mm-hmm. for it, but it sounds like it was backwards. And
yeah.
It was Iacocca saying,
Ford
look.
Was like, hey.
Interesting.
We got this cool car.
Interesting.
For the new enlarged bird designers, L. David Ash and Bill Boyer cited inspiration from new Ferraris and Ford cars of the 1950s for the exterior. Interior stylists retained the previous generation's two-and-two seating arrangements and developed 25 possible material and color choices for buyers to ponder, carrying on the custom of offering ample aesthetic options. Engine choices carried over from 1966, with a 390 or 428 cubic Whoa. Inch V8 both available, but either could now be had with a new four-barrel carburetor. That's funny. This, they're probably just... chugging around giant motors like that with two barrels.
It's gnarly.
428 V8 and a Thunderbird, that'd be sick as hell. The updated Thunderbird also benefited from a marketing scheme produced by clothing retailer Abercrombie and Fitch. They commissioned 5 fully optioned Thunderbirds, tacked Apollo on the end of the name, and each was updated with exciting features such as telephones, TVs,
what?
Reading lamps, and more.
What year is this?
This is... in 66. Though built for display in Abercrombie & Fitch shops, each one cost close to $15,000, up from a base price of $4,603. That's like spending $145,000 on a $44,000 car today. These significant changes, as well as the increasingly competitive field, caused Thunderbird sales to drop almost 50% between 1969 and 1971. When the time came to reimagine the T-Bird, a tidal wave of leadership change rushed the next generation's development. I mean, okay, this fifth gen, it's losing me.
I don't care for it.
I don't care for it.
Yeah. I don't mind it. I like
I
that.
I don't mind it.
It feels like the evolution of that front grille is pretty
it does,
cool, and I like that they're trying to see where they can go with it.
It does look more like a Galaxy, I'll say.
I will say it looks very much more like a Lincoln now because they're mm-hmm. sharing mm-hmm. a lot of components.
We'll be right back after these messages.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now back to the show.
As the faults of the fifth gen came into focus, Henry Ford II, a.k.a. Hank the Deuce, recruited Bunky Knudsen from General Motors to become Ford's president in the first quarter of 1968. Bunky Knudsen, huh? He started by laying out his vision for Ford's lineup, to which many longstanding executives disliked.
Uh-oh.
This political infighting resulted in Bunky only holding in the role until September of 1969, at which point Hank the Deuce fired him in favor of career Ford man Lee Iacocca.
Lee Iacocca.
Lee Iacocca.
Despite Bunky's short stint, his influence flooded upcoming Ford products.
Starring Tom Hanks as Bunky.
As Bunky. Including the upsized 1971 Ford Mustang and the 1970 and 71 Thunderbird, which featured the infamous Eagle Beak or Bunky Beak grill. Well, now I got a
Bunky Beak. Hey, yo, bring out the Bunky Beak.
Oh, that's a beak.
I got to see this Bunky Beak.
That's a beak. The Bunky Beak.
Oh, that is a Bunky Beak.
That's a big car. It's kind of losing. Now it just
looks like a Chevy.
It just looks, yeah. Oh.
That thing looks like it's going to dive into the river and pluck out a fish.
Yeah. I knew we should have called it the beaver. If it were the beaver, it would be flat in the front with the two
teeth. Yep. Prior to his release, Knudsen made it known he wished to revert the Thunderbird.
He wished to ruin the car forever.
I hate this car.
I don't like this car at all. He wished to revert the Thunderbird to its sporting roots. Those plans went out the window with his dismissal, and with Iacocca in charge, the Thunderbird was only destined to get bigger. When the 6th Gen debuted in 1972, it was the largest Thunderbird ever made. Critics lauded the big bird, and public response was very positive. Ford sold more than 50,000 Thunderbirds in 1972, a 60% jump over the previous year. In 1972, see, again, we're always talking... Oh, cars are getting bigger. Yeah. The industry's dying. This is the biggest Thunderbird ever, and it's like the most successful.
Everyone's
by
buying
a huge
one.
Margin.
Yeah. Well, it's more successful than the last one. Didn't they sell 100K one year? Anyways.
But a 60% jump.
They're going to revamp it to make it bigger.
Yeah.
And then
people love it.
So many.
We love our treats. We love having space.
Yeah.
You know, our roads are big.
We love that, the beak.
We love the beak. In 1972, Ford also celebrated the production of the 1,000,000th Thunderbird, which rolled off the assembly line on June 22nd. Unfortunately for Iacocca, though, the good times would not last.
Uh-oh.
By 1974, the Thunderbird had ballooned from an overall length of 214 inches in 1972 to 225 inches in 1974. That's longer than my... Ram.
Truck, yeah.
That's crazy. The latter carried a curb weight of nearly 5,000 pounds when fully optioned.
A heavy car.
And it's going to be making like 180 horsepower.
Yeah, dude. 1970. This was the biggest bird ever sold, and its size would prove unsustainable as new federal fuel economy and emission standards went into effect amid the 1970s fuel crisis. By 1975, sales of the oversized and underpowered Thunderbird had fallen to 42,000. To meet the new standards, Ford had to put the Thunderbird on a diet. The car hit the gym, getting 8 inches. Just imagine a car just like lifting weights. Getting 8 inches shorter and 900 pounds
That's
lighter.
That's not what the gym's for. You don't want to get shorter.
You do enough squats, you'll get shorter.
Doing my short gains.
Yeah. 8 inches shorter and 900 pounds lighter before making its seventh generation debut for 1977. Amid the rising fuel costs, mid-sized personal luxury was all the rage on the roadway, and the T-Bird hit the mark. For the first time ever, it sold more than 100,000 units in a year. In fact, Ford sold more than 250,000 of the cars during each of the three model years of the seventh generation.
It's crazy how this thing goes in dips, it feels like. Up and down, up and down.
Well, I think it's also has a lot to do with its competitors. And would you think it's competing both through its two-door and four-door and even through the 70s?
I'm trying to think who it's competing with.
Impala?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe.
Because it feels like they're making similar moves to what that car was doing up to the 80s and then in...
Yeah. The 7th Gen featured a detuned 302 V8, which improved fuel economy and helped bolster sales. Ford also continued the tradition of offering many colors and many interior choices, with a total of 16 exterior colors, 12 matching or contrasting vinyl roofs, and 13 colors for the bench or bucket seats. Dude, we just don't have the same options these days.
Yeah,
unless
that's
you're buying
so
like a
cool.
Rolls Royce, literally, you know? I know, it's awesome.
It seems like it didn't really get too affected, too, by the gas crisis, besides that detuned engine.
Right.
But that's what, 1978?
This is 77.
Yeah.
However, to get prices down, many standard features were removed. Oh. No longer did the car come with AC, bumper guards, color-keyed seat belts, or power windows. Instead, buyers could check up to 44 option boxes, driving the price of the base model up of $5,000, around $27,000 today, to as much as $12,000 or $64,000 in today's money. So like more than double with all the options. Mm-hmm. That's pretty gnarly.
There was this feeling that they had to compete with the German luxury and that they could do it. It's like you could spend that much money.
I'd rather go get
Or you could spend a lot less and have a car that kind of looks like it.
As the 80s began, another leadership changeover at Ford disrupted the T-Bird's development. It lost three important advocates, including Iacocca.
I love that we're calling it development instead of deterioration.
Who was fired in 1978. There's also VP Gene Bordenat and Hank the Deuce, who retired in 1980. Though it's arguable, he kept a hand in the business until his death. All three had influenced the next-gen Thunderbird, but none remained to see it completed. The result was a compromised product. Built on the smaller Fox platform, the new Thunderbird was 17 inches shorter and adopted squared-off styling. While the 302 V8 remained available, Ford introduced an even more feeble 4.2-liter V8 that made just 115 horsepower. For the first time ever, an inline-six was offered as well. The six-cylinder delivered up to 26 miles per gallon compared to the V8's 21, but performance lagged and sales plummeted. In 1982, just 45,412 units were sold, and only 40% carried the 200 cubic inch six-cylinder engine. Ugh. By the mid-80s, the Thunderbird had... By the mid-80s, the Thunderbird had nearly returned to its roots. It was a sporty, compact coupe capable of seating four. It also managed to recapture the personal luxury identity it helped define, and even rode on a footprint similar to the original. But one thing hadn't come full circle, the performance. Though design work for the 9th generation model began in 1978, the long lead time was needed to achieve advanced aerodynamics. The result was a rounded, sleek aero coupe, which was a breath of fresh air compared to the boxy malaise-era designs. Under the hood, things got really interesting.
We also just got done praising the boxy malaise-era designs pretty heavily.
Under the hood, things got really interesting. The 5-liter V8 returned to the Bird, and a 3.8-liter V6 could be optioned. But the Turbo 4 was what really got people talking. In its debut year of 1983, the 4-banger produced 142 horsepower, 12 more than the V8.
I did not know that.
Yeah, me neither. By 1985, the Turbo T-Bird's horses jumped to 155. The turbo option initially came only with a BorgWarner 5-speed manual transmission, marking the first non-auto option in a T-Bird since 1960. With the gauge of success being sales, you can say Ford had a winner on its hands. A total of 121,999 T-Birds flew the coupe in 1983, including more than 12,500 turbo variants.
I think it's notable, too, that since the first two or three gens of Thunderbird, from today, if you looked at subsequent generations, you'd be like, that's a Thunderbird? Mm-hmm. I think this is the first generation where you're like,
yeah,
that's a Thunderbird, yeah, you know, yeah, like yeah. Where it's in, you know, it is a shape of a Thunderbird.
Those numbers continued to climb, and Ford aimed to capitalize even further. The 9th generation, still riding on the Fox platform, went through a major refresh for 1987. I love that it's like every 3 years.
I know.
It's crazy.
It's unreal.
Major refresh for 1987, aesthetically and mechanically. While the updated interior and exterior shined, The addition of an intercooler on the turbo coupe gave it the same drivetrain as the Mustang SVO.
Oh, that's cool.
When equipped with the manual transmission, it pushed 190 horsepower, resulting in an 8-second 0-60 and 143 mile per hour top speed. Critics loved it, and Motor Trend named the turbo coupe its 1987 car of the year. Dude, I gotta see this car.
Would it be cool to build one of these to like a track spec, put a roll cage in it?
I actually do. Mm-hmm. I like these a lot.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that hood, the way the hood comes down on that is pretty sick, too.
It would make it probably a good bomb.
What kind of
car.
Beak is that?
That's right. It's the beak.
It's the beak. A major overhaul arrived just in time for the 1990s, all centered around a single engine option, the Essex overhead valve 3.8-liter V6, which came in naturally aspirated and supercharged variants. The Thunderbird won Motor Trend's Car of the Year for the third time in 1989, specifically the Super Coupe, or SC for short. It's rated at 210 horsepower and pushing 12 pounds of boost. The SC could run 0 to 60 in 7.5 seconds and hit a top speed of nearly 140 miles per hour. Honestly, at that time, for how big this car is, that's pretty impressive.
That's impressive.
That's cool, man. Like that's neat, dude.
And
that's
you can
swap out all the Fox body components, too, if you wanted.
Yeah, dude. Now we're talking, Jimbo. That's neat. These are cool, too. I like these.
Yeah.
I like these. I can smell the cigarettes
that's
already.
That's a Radwood car.
Yeah, these are cool,
I
though.
I can smell the cigarettes.
Like,
pretty good.
This is sick, dude. Thunderbird SC.
All right, we all getting Thunderbird
SCs,
then?
We're all getting SCs, dude. Yeah. We're all getting probes. We're all getting
SCs.
We'll
be the Thunder Boys.
Yeah, dude. Straight up. This iteration of the T-Bird found particular success in NASCAR in the 1990s. In 1992, Alan Kulwicki drove a Thunderbird in his championship run, 1992. In 1997, Ford also won the NASCAR Manufacturers Championship. It was a great way to celebrate the end of the Thunderbird. Because after 43 years of continuous production, Ford pulled the plug that same year.
Yay.
What? For more than 40 years, the Thunderbird had been Ford's most malleable model. It could take many forms because its name always reflected what it set out to be, personal luxury. The T-Bird could be described as luxurious, sporty, fun, and
personal.
and occasionally fast. When management called it quits on the iconic nameplate, an uproar ensued. Inside and outside of the blue oval, Ford's upper management listened, and as they watched retro-inspired cars like the Volkswagen Bug and Plymouth Prowler roll down the streets, Ford decided to get a slice of that sweet, sweet nostalgia pie. Almost as soon as the Thunderbird's demise was announced, a small team at Ford got together to spend their evenings trying to save it.
A little skunkworks action.
The secret mission was reminiscent of the original Thunderbird's development. Global VP of Design Jack Telnak caught wind of the project and became a major proponent until his retirement. His replacement, Jay Mays, famous for reworking the iconic VW Beetle that had recently hit the streets, brought his retro experience to the table and pushed the plan forward. The end result was a throwback to the original baby birds of the mid-50s, with a concept debuting at the 1999 North American International Auto Show. It generated positive enough response that Ford's new president, Jack Nasser, gave it the green light. The retro Thunderbird had a single-engine option, a 3.8-liter Jaguar V8 that produced 252 horsepower.
This was when Ford was making Jaguar Tauruses.
It was not the three-valve V8. It was a Jaguar V8. This thing was connected to a five-speed auto with a select-shift auto-stick option. When sales started for the 2002 model year, it appeared Ford had another winner on its hands. More than 30,000 sold that year, and the T-Bird earned its fourth Motor Trend Car of the Year award. I did not know it won that. That's crazy.
It's got to be some kind of record. Four?
Yeah.
Four in a row.
For one model?
Unfortunately, though, lofty sales goals failed to hit their mark. Sales fell by more than 50% in 2003.
It's all the people who were excited about the car had already bought it.
Yep, exactly. And sales continued to drop year over year. It held on through 2005, marking the 50th anniversary of the Ford Thunderbird.
If we could just make it to 50.
A proper exclamation point for an iconic model. In its five decades, the Thunderbird reinvented itself time and time again. From taking direct aim at Corvette and defining style in the 1960s, to sharing assembly lines with its upscale siblings from Lincoln, and reverting back to its former self just in time for its 50th birthday, the Thunderbird always remained true to its roots as a personal luxury vehicle.
While it has been 20 years since the Thunderbird flew, Ford did renew the trademark name in 2021. Could there be another resurrection in the future?
No, they're just keeping the name.
Only time will tell.
But hopefully it's electric.
Yeah.
With a name like Thunderbird, it better be.
They'll call it the Lightning Bird.
Lightning Bird. Only time will tell, but if history teaches us anything, it's that legends never die.
Whoa.
And that's the story of the Thunderbird.
Dude, chills.
Guys,
chills.
Buy your
No, don't.
Set your Craigslist sale area to Palm Springs.
Oh, 10th gen actually is what you want.
I feel like I never see these ones too now.
The latest ones?
The new one, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't
see
the
new one that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. The newest.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of
them. That is weird. That was 20 years ago, huh?
I know.
Jeez.
Dude.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
Dude, Xbox was out then. The original.
Wow. The original OG Xbox. Wow. Yeah, you could go buy a copy of Halo 2 in that car. So that's the Thunderbird. I'm hyped on him now. I'm more hyped on him than the probe, honestly. The probe.
I'll be honest. I like this more than the probe.
Thank you guys so much. Thanks to our writer this week, Brian Corey, and our primary source for this episode was Thunderbird 50 Years by Alan H. Tast. Follow Bart at BidsBardo on social media. Follow Jimmy at RussellJimmy.jp. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to our crew, as always. We got Audrey, Edgar, and Mark behind the camera there. And thanks to you for listening, as always. We will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.